On behalf of the North Carolina Oncology Association and the South Carolina Oncology Society, we welcome you today to day two of our joint session. Under the leadership yesterday of Dr. Martin Palmieri, the president of North Carolina, and Dr. Gore of South Carolina, we had a great discussion yesterday that focused really a lot on healthcare policy and coding. We had great discussions regarding state and local and also national healthcare policy, and we all feel that in our practice, how that impacts our patients. And then Dr. Marty McCary gave our keynote address yesterday, and he did a great job talking about how he thought we could decrease the cost of healthcare. And I think the most interesting slide from his presentation was, it looks like it, if you take the entire federal budget, if you add all the different components, about 50% of the federal budget goes to healthcare costs. So all that stuff is very interesting and impactful, but today we get to come together and do what we all love, and that is to talk about the clinical side of oncology. And so today, under the leadership of Dr. Neil Love, who's joining us remotely, and the great crew here at Research to Practice, we're going to have a great clinical discussion of recent advances and new directions in oncology care. So I'll start, we're going to go through six different disease types. We're going to start with breast cancer, GI, GU, and then in the afternoon we'll do heme malignancies, GYN malignancies, and end with lung cancer. So today I'll pass this off to my partner and my practice, Dr. Nasfat Shahadeh, who will introduce our panelists and get started with the breast cancer discussion. Thank you.
Good morning. I'd like to introduce the faculty here. We're going to have 1 hour for breast cancer today. Dr. Harold Burstein from Harvard Medical School. He's a well-known expert in breast cancer, as well as Dr. Virginia Kaklamani from UT Health, Texas. Thanks for joining us today. And maybe Dr. Neil Love want to say a couple of things before the start.
So welcome, everyone. We're really excited to be working with you again. We have a great faculty, both on-site as well as remotely. We always like to try something a little bit different, and today we challenge the faculty to create a different approach to a slide presentation. We asked them, and we've tried this in the past, but we tried a different flavor each time. We asked them, instead of doing a traditional presentation, to do a chalk talk. And we really loaded up their inventory with questions that we know that oncologists in practice have, particularly about new developments, newly approved therapies that are coming into practice, and others that are on the way. So you'll see today the 12 faculty have each taken a different approach to doing their so-called chalk talks. We're really excited to see how this plays out today. Also, as we go through the meeting today, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by the faculty, for those of you in the room, you can submit them through the iPad. And for those of you who are online, you can submit them through the chat room. And one of my main roles here will be sifting through the many questions that I know we're going to get today. We have hundreds of people signed up online in addition to those in the room. So we'll be going through those and bringing them to everyone's attention. But we're really excited to see where they're headed. Being a general medical oncology today is an incredible challenge. So many new things developing. We're going to try to touch on as many of these as we have time today. So with that, I'll turn it back to you, Nasfat, and we're going to start out, I think, with our first presentation from Hal.
Thank you, Dr. Burstein.
Well, good morning, and it's great to be here. And if you spent yesterday learning how to save costs in the healthcare system, we are here today to tell you how to bankrupt the healthcare system with expensive new oncology drugs. And the good news is there has been extraordinary excitement and development in breast cancer and in all of the tumor types. The challenge is how do we afford that as a society, and how do we make it work for our patients so that they can get the best care. So it's an exciting conference, and I'm thrilled to be with you. And Virginia and I had a great discussion earlier this morning about the session and about what's happening in oncology today. We're looking forward to it. Okay, so first of the modules was on HER2-positive and HER2-low breast cancer. And the first question I was posed is, how does one generally sequence trastuzumab deruxtecan and tucatinib trastuzumab capecitabine for patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer with or without brain metastases. So, as you know well, the brain remains a relative sanctuary site for many treatments for HER2-positive breast cancer and for triple-negative breast cancer, such that we not infrequently encounter patients where the disease is well controlled systemically from the neck down, if you will, but where they have brain metastases or brain progression. And the question is, with some of these newer regimens that have shown activity in the CNS, what would we optimally do? So the first thing to say is that there is no magic drug that works in the brain tumor preferentially compared to other parts of the body. And my colleague Nancy Lin at Dana-Farber, who is really a genius at managing brain metastases and has done tremendous numbers of studies on the challenge of caring for patients with CNS or leptomeningeal disease, has sort of articulated this point, which I affectionately call the Lin rule, which is the best drug to treat the brain is the best drug you got. There's no separate drug which uniquely works in the brain or uniquely works in the rest of the body. It's the best drug you got. And so that's the thing you're trying to figure out for a given patient at a given moment in time. What's the most likely drug to be active, full stop? And if it works in the rest of the body, it'll hopefully work in the brain as well. So if you were to, oh, sorry, I'm not sure I got the slides in the right sequence here. Okay, so what does that mean in practicality? So at the moment, our first line treatment for HER2-positive metastatic disease often looks like a taxane with trastuzumab and pertuzumab, or a THP kind of regimen. And then almost all those patients will have response to therapy. And then if the tumor is ER-positive, we actually take away the chemotherapy and introduce an endocrine agent to maintain that. And if when they progress, typically, we're looking at trastuzumab deruxtecan, and I think we have some of the data here to point that out because of the activity that's been seen in several of the recent trials, including randomized trials. It's then down the road when they tend to develop CNS metastases. And so for patients who've already seen TDXD, I think the tucatinib-based regimen is a very reasonable option. For patients who have yet to see trastuzumab deruxtecan, that usually would be our preferred choice at that point. Just a quick reminder, other drugs can work in the CNS, so platinating agents in particular are active in the CNS. Anthracyclines can be active in the CNS. These days, a lot of patients with HER2 disease will have not seen an anthracycline, so there are some older tricks you can use as well. So the next question was, how should trastuzumab deruxtecan be sequenced relative to other available agents for ER-positive HER2-low breast cancers? So the data to reference here is the recent DESTINY-Breast04 study. So this is where they took trastuzumab deruxtecan and compared it with the treating physician's choice of various chemotherapy drugs, and I've listed on the right-hand side the options. It was largely eribulin-based, but also some patients got capecitabine or nab-paclitaxel, gemcitabine, and so forth. And this was in tumors that were HER2-low, so that's HER2-1+ or HER2-2+, but FISH negative. And as you know well, in the DESTINY-Breast04 study, TDXD outperformed these other agents in both the ER-positive HER2-low subset, but also in the ER-negative HER2-low subset, with improvements in response rate and progression-free survival. So the question has been, how do we actually integrate this in the setting of patients who have ER-positive HER2-low disease? And so here's my quick algorithm for such approaches. The first thing you want to do is maximize your endocrine plus targeted therapy approaches. And the really important second thing you want to do is to maximize your endocrine and targeted therapy approaches. And that's also a really important third thing to do. So you want to squeeze the endocrine therapy towel as tightly as you can. And Virginia is going to walk you through in a moment some of the exciting new stories there, because there are a lot of new drugs in that space as well. Once the patients really become resistant to endocrine-based therapy, then at some point one needs to sort of flip the switch towards chemotherapy. For a lot of our patients, I actually use capecitabine as a first-line option. It's typically not a drug they would have seen in the adjuvant setting, and it's very well tolerated in the sense that it doesn't require IV administration. A patient can put it in her pocketbook or tote bag and travel with it. It's the kind of thing that you don't have to completely disrupt your week week-to-week daily schedule for, and you don't lose your hair. So if possible, that's a great first option. Second line option would then typically be either paclitaxel or TDXD. Third line is whichever one of those you haven't given. And then fourth line becomes a variety of agents that we've used historically for a long time now, ribulin, platinating agents, anthracyclines or alkylators if they haven't had it already, vinorelbine, ixabepilone, gemcitabine, and so forth. And there's no known optimal sequence. In fact, for all of those drugs, we actually have no idea at this point what their true efficacy is now that patients are getting all these new drugs in the ER-positive space like CDK4/6 inhibitors and the TDXD in the earlier lines of setting. And so finally, I guess we go back to this question of, or the related question of the tucatinib and the TDXD for patients who have HER2-positive tumors and residual disease after neoadjuvant therapy. So right now, of course, we use trastuzumab emtansine because of the results of the Catherine study, where they showed that if you had residual tumor after trastuzumab-based chemotherapy, and if you either continued trastuzumab or switched to TDM1, trastuzumab emtansine, that you saw better results with the TDM1. So which might be better? This is a speculation handicapping exercise, and I'm not very good at that. If I could pick winners in the stock market, I would not be here on a Saturday morning. I would be up on Wall Street making a fortune. So there have been two studies to look at these drugs in the metastatic setting. The HER2CLIMB study we alluded to a few moments ago, it's the study that looked at trastuzumab capecitabine with or without tucatinib, and DESTINY-Breast03, which looked at TDXD versus dealer's choice, if you will, of chemotherapy and trastuzumab-based regimens. What these studies share in the efficacy winner arm is that almost all the patients that had trastuzumab, pertuzumab, most had had, actually DESTINY-Breast03, excuse me, was TDM1 versus TDXD. HER2CLIMB, they'd all had TDM1. If you look at the response rates and you compare the tucatinib-based arm under HER2CLIMB or the TDXD arm in DESTINY-Breast03, and you sort of squint your eyes, it certainly looks like the TDXD is a more potent drug. It's got a higher response rate, a substantially longer progression-free survival, and a longer median overall survival. But this is comparing apples to tangerines, and so it's hard to know exactly which is better. The dilemma from a clinical point of view is that while both of these drugs look to be more potent than TDM1, they're also both more toxic. And that toxicity is not a trivial thing with either the tucatinib-based regimen or with the TDXD. And so I think that when we begin to look at the likely outcomes of these studies, you would imagine that perhaps both of these regimens would be superior to TDM1. But one of the other things you want to pay a lot of attention to is risk stratifying these so that we're using an appropriate amount of therapy. Patients who have really trivial amounts of residual disease may be still adequately treated with TDM1, I suppose. Those with more extensive might need the more intensive therapies. And then finally, I guess, on my topic list is which patient should be offered 1 year of extended adjuvant neratinib. So this is the long-term follow-up from the so-called EXTANET study. It was a study that looked at standard of care for HER2-positive breast cancer, and then at the end of 1 year of trastuzumab, patients were randomized to either no further treatment or to neratinib, the small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And in the subset of patients who had ER-positive, HER2-positive breast cancer, extended therapy with neratinib did contribute to a difference in progression or recurrence-free survival, which has been robust over many years of follow-up. The dilemma with this study is that in the era when it was being run, our treatment looked pretty substantially different. So, for instance, while they got trastuzumab, none of them would have received pertuzumab-based therapy, which we routinely offer to node-positive tumors. None of them would have received TDM1 in sort of a salvage pathway after after trastuzumab-based neoadjuvant treatment. And our current algorithm for HER2-positive early-stage disease is if they have small, low-risk tumors, like stage 1, we just give paclitaxel trastuzumab. The metastatic recurrence rate is less than 5%. They do very well on average. And if they have higher risk disease, we typically use neoadjuvant therapy, typically like a TCHP regimen, and then we risk stratify based on whether they have PathCR or not. So in my practice, when you sort of look at that, there's relatively few patients who would still be candidates for neratinib-based therapy, though I know that you tend to use it in higher risk ER-positive cancers.
I do, and as you mentioned, there are the challenges with the studies, but unfortunately in oncology, we always work with those challenges because we always have data gaps. But it is a regimen that is challenging to give because of the diarrhea.
So just to summarize my own thoughts, it would be that, you know, for higher risk cases, you might think about it, we're actually giving them a different approach. If they have a path CR, I wouldn't offer it. If they had extensive residual ER-positive, HER2-positive disease, that might be the patient where I'd think about it. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Dr. Love, if you have any questions from the virtual attendees.
So, yeah, we're getting some interesting cases here, and also we've accumulated some questions from other webinars we never got a chance to talk about. But just to pick up on a couple of things that Hal brought up, first, I'm curious, Virginia, in terms of your second-line therapy in the metastatic setting, one of the big questions we hear a lot is, what do you do in a patient who's progressing on a regimen with, you know, taxane, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and a patient who has brain mets? You know, a lot of people, of course, people think generally about second-line T-DXd, but then when you have brain mets, that's a different issue. I'm curious, Virginia, how you think through that situation.
So what I typically do is I try to address the brain with localized therapy. If that is a SRS or if that is a resection of the brain metastasis and so forth, try to avoid obviously whole brain RT, although this is now becoming much less toxic than it was with hippocampal avoidance. But the reminder for all of us is that the HER2CLIMB trial is really still the only large randomized trial that included patients with active brain mets. And so this is something that we want to keep in mind, but to Hal's point, if a drug is active in the periphery, it's going to be active in the brain. And honestly, the brain gets seeded by the periphery. So if we're able to control the peripheral disease and the T-DXd data is really very impressive, then I think we will get a nice response in the brain. And the studies that looked at T-DXd in the brain showed relatively good outcomes. I'm saying relatively good because this is brain metastasis, which is one of the major issues that we have. So I typically favor T-DXd to tucatinib, and I will use tucatinib in my third line.
I have a question for the same patients. Does it change your, you know, approach if somebody has ER strongly positive, triple positive, we maybe TKI better CNS penetration in these patients, or your approach is the same?
So in one of these programs several years ago, Hal said, and I still remember this, that the minute a patient has brain metastases, there is no blood-brain barrier. And I really agree with that. The cancer cells are big cells. For them to get into the brain, that means that there's leakage of the CNS. And so in that case, any drug, and we see these large antibody drug conjugates as well, will penetrate the blood-brain barrier. And we did studies with sacituzumab in a different setting, and we actually measured the concentration of sacituzumab in the CNS met, and it's there. It gets in there.
Thank you.
I'm glad you brought up sacituzumab because, Hal, you also brought up the issue, of course, of HER2-low, which is a gigantic issue that's now been out there the last few months. And we talked a little bit about sequencing, but I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more, Hal, in terms of when you bring in T-DXd and what are some of the factors that you consider in terms of, you know, how sick the patient is. Maybe start out with a sort of hormone receptor negative. One of the big debates there is what comes first, T-DXd or sacituzumab. How do you think that went through, Hal?
So the good news is we have a growing arsenal of tools that we can use in both triple-negative and HER2-low breast cancer. And then having these antibody-drug conjugates come along has been remarkably exciting, and we've all seen dramatic responses. From a patient point of view, of course, if they didn't know it was a sexy bioengineered antibody-drug conjugate molecule, getting these drugs feels like getting chemotherapy, right? I mean, they get nausea, fatigue, low blood counts, and their hair thins out and falls out. So I think that that's one piece to remember, that this is really just another set of tools that we have. And from a patient point of view, it's a lot like getting chemotherapy. We don't know the optimal sequence, and while the antibody targets differ, so sacituzumab obviously is an anti-TROP2 antibody, TDXD is an anti-HER2 antibody, the payloads are actually very similar. They're not quite exactly the same, but they're both irinotecan-based payloads. And what we don't know is, if you've already had one of these ADCs, does somehow shifting the antibody with a very similar payload actually change the clinical activity of the drug? So I think we're all getting more familiar with both of these drugs and the logistics of administering them and the side effect profile. I think one would be hard-pressed to say there's a standard approach, but for triple-negative disease, first thing is to test for PD-L1 expression, and if it's PD-L1 positive, then they get pembrolizumab-based chemotherapy in the first line. At second line, it's one of those ADCs, either sacituzumab or trastuzumab deruxtecan. Probably I'm giving more TDXD right now, but I don't know that there's any science to that. Third line, we occasionally try switching back, or we try other chemotherapy options that the patient hasn't already seen at that point. You know, in the United States, most patients are diagnosed with early stage breast cancer. And so when they recur with metastatic disease, they've already had flavors of chemotherapy, particularly triple negative disease. And nowadays, they've already had anthracyclines and alkylators and taxanes and platinating agents. And so, you know, your repertoire is winnowed in the more traditional chemotherapy space for most women who have metastatic stage 4 triple negative disease.
So in a second, we're going to ask Virginia to give the beginning of her talk. But interestingly, in the chat room, two people in a row ask about the same topic. So Neela and also John, Dr. John Layton, are both asking Virginia about leptomeningeal disease. Do you give IT therapy? Do you use IT trastuzumab? Do you just use your best systemic therapy? Any pearls of Virginia about leptomeningeal disease?
So that's probably the toughest thing we face as breast medical oncologists. Up until recently, what we've been doing is actually using high-dose methotrexate. And when I say high-dose, I'm talking about 8 grams. I'm not talking about 1 or 2 or 3, which is a pretty big dose. Now with the antibody-drug conjugates, I think this is another evolving field. IT chemo I typically use for maintenance therapy. So if we're going to use high-dose methotrexate, we do that every 2 weeks, and then once the CSF has cleared, then we can do IT chemo just to maintain that response. Honestly, it's a few of these patients that will be able to clear the CSF and with this approach, and that we'll be able to continue treating them. And so this is really extremely challenging.
I stopped using intrathecal chemotherapy a decade ago. I never saw it meaningfully work. It was always awful from a patient point of view. And I think what we often do is as much judicious radiotherapy as we can if they have Cauda Aquina syndrome or other focal manifestations of leptomeningeal disease, and then try systemic treatment. But truly, it's been over a decade since I had someone get IT chemotherapy. And for the reasons that Virginia alluded to, it's so unsatisfying from a clinical outcomes point of view.
A couple of practical questions. First, to remind the audience, if you have questions, please submit through the iPad, you know, devices that you have, and I'll read them. You know, we're excited about the HER2-LU. Do you retest these patients? I'm sure you got these questions. And somebody who has de novo metastatic disease, do you do brain MRI at the beginning?
I'll answer the second question first. I typically don't do brain MRI unless a patient has symptomatic disease. Many of my colleagues do brain MRI at every progression. So you'll see a lot of different ways of doing this. And honestly, we don't have data that one way is better than the other. As far as HER2-low, I mean, this is a new entity, not prognostically, but predictively, because we have TDXD and possibly other agents in the future. And so I have started in my notes, instead of saying HER2 positive or negative, now I'm saying 0, 1, 2, because this comes back for us and it just makes a big difference in treatment decisions. And yes, so I will be using TDXD in those HER2-low patients, especially the ER positives, but also the triple negatives.
So, Virginia, we already are getting questions about, oral SERDs and HER2 low and ER positive. We'll get to that later. But we ask you to review some key issues related to localized breast cancer, oncotype, and also the ever-controversial use of CDK in the adjuvant setting.
Perfect. Thank you. So the first question was, in what situation, if any, do we order other genomic tests except for besides the 21 gene recurrence score, near positive, HER2 negative localized breast cancer? What is the usual approach in the adjuvant therapy for both pre- and postmenopausal patients with low intermediate risk score? And do we use the genomic assays in the new adjuvant setting? So a lot of questions here, but I tried to summarize this as best I could with this slide. I use the breast cancer index for late risk of recurrence to decide whether I should give extended endocrine therapy to. And obviously there's also the risks that have to do with the pathologic stage at the time of diagnosis that play a role there as well. For my postmenopausal patients, anybody with 0 to 3 positive lymph nodes, I use Oncotype, the 21 recurrence gene score, and anybody that has a score of 25 or less, I do not recommend chemotherapy, and that's based on the results from both TAILORx and RxPONDER. For my premenopausal patients that have negative node negative disease, this is where it's a little more tricky. The 21 recurrence score, if they have one of 0 to 18, I typically don't recommend chemotherapy. 18 to 25, I use this model that we can find on the website called RSClin that adds the clinical characteristics of the tumor, and it gives us more individualized benefit from chemotherapy. And I think patients appreciate to know whether it's a 3%, a 4%, or an 8% benefit, and that might make a pretty big difference. Now, for the premenopausal patients with 1 to 3 positive lymph nodes, I think this is where the debate comes, and a lot of people believe that the benefit of chemotherapy has to do with ovarian suppression. I typically recommend for the majority of patients chemotherapy based on the data from RxPONDER, but obviously we need a lot of data in this patient population. Now, this year at SABCS, there was the TAILORx trial that was presented that looked at updated results. And what I liked from this trial was this slide. And you can see patients here that were premenopausal under the age of 40, had an intermediate risk score. And you can really see that there wasn't much benefit from chemotherapy in those younger women. Where you're seeing the benefit is women between the age of 41 to 50, where the thought is maybe that the chemotherapy does offer ovarian suppression, whereas in the younger women, it probably does not completely suppress their ovaries. So this was pretty interesting to me because this also helps, again, in deciding in this intermediate risk category whether we should be offering chemotherapy. And if you see on the right hand of the slide, these are the absolute benefits from chemotherapy in the recurrence score 21 to 25 or 16 to 20. And you can see that really the 21 to 25 category is the one that seems to get most of the benefit from chemotherapy. As far as the node-positive patient population, this is the most updated results from RxPONDER, and it clearly shows us postmenopausal women do not get a benefit from chemotherapy if they have a score of 0 to 25. And in the premenopausal patients, there is a benefit, and again, we're going to be wondering for several years until the NRG trial is completed whether this benefit is ovarian suppression or chemotherapy itself. Now, this is some of the data with the breast cancer index from two trials, the MA17 and the ATOM trial, both of those trials suggesting that in this high BCI patient population, there is a clinically meaningful benefit with extended endocrine therapy. And so in this patient population, assuming that the patients are willing to take another 5 years of endocrine therapy, I will do the BCI just so that I can help with the decision. Now, the second question that I was asked was when to use adjuvant abemaciclib for these ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer patients, and there is a little bit of a debate with that. Helen and I were talking about that yesterday, actually. And these are the inclusion criteria from MONARCH E. More than 4 or more positive nodes, and if you have 1 to 3 positive nodes, either grade 3, tumor more than 5 centimeters, or a Ki-67 of 20% or more. And the reason there's the debate is because the FDA approved abemaciclib in this Ki-67 20% or more group, whereas the data suggests that patients will have a benefit regardless of that Ki-67 score. And this is data from the MONARCH E trial suggesting that obviously patients with a high Ki-67 have worse outcomes, but the benefit of abemaciclib is regardless of what that Ki-67 is. So I personally give or recommend abemaciclib regardless of the Ki-67 if a patient meets the criteria for MONARCH E.
Thank you.
We're getting a ton of questions in the chat room. I'm sure we won't be able to get to all of them, but I need to ask Hal. We work with your colleague at Dana-Farber, Ann Partridge, who did a presentation at San Antonio that a lot of people really viewed as very important, the so-called positive trial. We had a webinar with her last week, and the idea here was to take patients on long-term endocrine therapy and allow them to become pregnant after 18 months to 3 years. Any thoughts about that data, Hal? Have you been doing that in your practice? And any thoughts about that strategy to offer women the opportunity to hold off on hormonal therapy and attempt to conceive?
Well, our patients for years have been becoming pregnant after breast cancer, and obviously that requires interrupting whatever therapy you're on. And retrospective studies had shown that actually the women who chose to become pregnant actually did better on average than women who did not, and the traditional explanation was it was a selection bias, that the women who opted to become pregnant had made some kind of risk assessment with their clinical team and thought it was safe to do so. But there really had never been a prospective study to look at this, and so in a global trial led by the IBCSG called the Positive Study, they offered women the opportunity to stop endocrine therapy after a minimum of around 18 months, 2 years of treatment. And then they wanted to see how many women would in fact conceive a child, have a child, and what their clinical outcomes would be. And they benchmarked that against the SOFT and TECH study, which was one of the canonical adjuvant trials that looked at ovarian suppression. And what they showed was a couple things. One is that of the 500 or so women who entered this registry, essentially, a good number actually became pregnant, and they had a lot of babies. So it was very exciting to be at San Antonio because they had a picture of babies, and we don't get to see that too often. It was very fun. And the babies seemed to be doing as well, and the pregnancy seemed to be as healthy as any other pregnancies would be on average. And when they looked at cancer recurrence outcomes, there was really no difference when you benchmarked it against the SOFT and TECH trial. So there are a couple of really important things here. I mean, the first is for a woman who wants to become pregnant, the quick answer is it looks like it is safe to do that and then presumably resume endocrine therapy. This doesn't mean the cancer is not coming back. And if you actually look at the curves, you might be sobered to look at the risk of recurrence in the next 3 to 5 years, because it was about 8 to 10% for the cohort as a whole. And if you had higher risk cancers, it was even higher, which makes sense. So it's not that there's no risk of the cancer coming back. And that is actually really important information for patients to think through when they're making this very important individual choice. And the final comment is, I no longer worry about it if a patient's not taking every pill in their box, because it turns out you can stop therapy for a year and a half, and it doesn't actually seem to affect your long-term outcome. So I'm no longer interested in adherence studies that measure 85% or 90% adherence. It turns out you can stop for like a year and you'll be okay. So that's another important lesson that you can share with people.
So we got our first circulating DNA question about whether or not you should look at that. I won't even get into that right now because we're probably going to talk about it all day long.
I had the under for 30 minutes into the session, so I think I won that.
Small question to Virginia. With the biomarkers, Oncotype, do you use any other biological markers like Mammabrint? Or when you look at the ASCO, you know, guidelines, pretty much just Oncotype DX probably?
Yeah, so the 21 gene recurrence score seems to be the one that ASCO is advocating for the most, mostly because of the prospective data that we have with the 21 recurrence gene score, whereas we don't have that with the other assays, and that's why I preferentially use that one. I will use, for example, the 70 recurrence score in select categories, what I consider a low-risk triple-negative breast cancer patient. Can I avoid chemotherapy? There's a small number of them that will have a low risk there, but that's a minority.
Thank you.
So Virginia, we asked you to review a couple other topics just to sort of get it out on the table. We might bring back some of the questions that we're getting about these first topics, but let's just kind of get your stuff out on the table here, particularly the later line endocrine stuff. All of a sudden, There's a lot going on in ER-positive metastatic disease, thank the Lord, but it also is making it pretty complicated. So help us straighten it out a little bit, Virginia.
I will do my best. So the first question I was asked was in patients with early stage breast cancer, when do we do genetic testing? And is somatic testing versus germline testing okay and so forth? And then the use of a laparib. And the germline testing, what I typically do is I use the NCCN guidelines that are now extremely inclusive. And I also do germline testing based on the inclusion criteria of the Olympia trial, which is the trial that used adjuvant olaparib, and you can see the criteria here. And the reason I do that is because we either can change our treatment decisions, or obviously the implication of a positive genetic test is not just for that individual, but also for the rest of their family. And so this is the most recent analysis from the Olympia trial showing an improvement not just in disease-free but also overall survival. And I think this is pretty powerful. You're looking at the numbers. We're talking about a 3% absolute improvement. The curves are not extremely easy to see. But one of the things to keep in mind is that these patients are all doing pretty well with the olaparib group having an 86.4% overall survival in the 3 years. So I think with this, olaparib should really be a standard of care option. Now, as far as germline versus somatic testing, this is a list of the differences, and my genetic counselor helped with this as well, but they're not the same. So if you're doing somatic testing and you're finding that the patient does not have a deleterious BRCA1 or 2 mutation, don't stop there if the patient is eligible for germline testing. Do your germline testing. Sometimes the somatic testing is going to miss these mutations. And also, the classification of these mutations is different because there are different labs that are using the data sets. And so one of these mutations may be classified as a variant in the somatic testing, but may actually be a deleterious mutation in the germline testing because of the different databases. So just be very careful. As far as using a CDK4/6 inhibitor, here's the other question in the first line setting. And are there we have three CDK4/6 inhibitors. Are there differences? Are they all the same? We had a big debate at the San Antonio Symposium last year on this. These are the data. The data suggests that the Paloma 2 trial that used the palbociclib did not have an improvement in overall survival, but there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival. The other two trials, the Mona Lisa and the Monarch 3, had an overall survival improvement, although the Monarch 3 hasn't reached its mark yet, but the thought is that with the next update, it probably will. So I don't know if they're all the same or different. I typically tend to use ribociclib in that first line setting because of the survival benefit. But I think, you know, we've been using palbociclib for the past 8 years, and we've had exceptionally good outcomes with this drug as well. And the field that's become extremely crowded as of San Antonio is this field of metastatic breast cancer and ER-positive disease, progression post CDK4/6 inhibitor, and what do we do? Do we use alpelisib? Do we use an oral SERD and so forth? And so these are just some of the points. If a patient's cancer has a PIK3CA mutation, alpelisib is an option based on the results from the SOLAR-1 trial. Not an easy drug to give. Quite a lot of hyperglycemia, some diarrhea and so forth, so not easy to give, and that's been a limitation for that drug. If a patient's cancer has an ESR1 mutation, we just had the approval of elacestrant. Elacestrant costs $21,000 a month. So that comes to your discussions from yesterday on how to improve our healthcare system. We can always consider everolimus an old one, but a good one, and I think we've become much better at being able to get patients through it, especially with mouthwashes. And then when we switch to chemotherapy, now we have results from both the TROPiCS-02 trial and the use of sacituzumab, which just approved a week or two ago by the FDA, and of course with the HER2-low data that Hal mentioned, we can use T-DXd. And then finally, the CAPItello trial looked at capivasertib, which is an AKT inhibitor that had pretty interesting results, and I think this is something that we're going to be using in the future as well. Just a couple of points on elacestrant. There's some data we presented at San Antonio suggesting that if patients still have endocrine-sensitive disease, which we can't completely define, but this was a way to define it, and they have a tumor with ESR1 mutations, there was an 8.6-month median PFS with elacestrant. So I think relatively clinically meaningful, but again, the cost is going to be an issue. This is the results from the CAPItello trial showing in patients, regardless of whether they had a mutation in the AKT pathway, that they did get a benefit from capivasertib, and I think that CAPI is probably going to replace alpelisib in the future. And some results here from the TROPiCS-02, again, suggesting not just a PFS improvement with sacituzumab, but also an OS improvement with sacituzumab in this patient population. So this is my way of thinking of things, and I'm not sure that this is going to be the same in a year from now, but first line, I think endocrine therapy and CDK4/6 inhibitors is probably what most of us do. And after that, we need to think of whether the tumor is still endocrine sensitive or not. And I'm using this 12-month response here, but that is definitely debatable. If we see a tumor that is not endocrine sensitive, giving single agent endocrine therapy probably not the best thing for this patient. And then we either move to ADCs chemotherapy or we consider a dual targeted therapy with either alpelisib, eventually capivasertib, or even everolimus. But if a patient's tumor is still endocrine sensitive, then ESR1 mutation status is probably a good way of looking at things and potentially giving elacestrant to these patients or giving a dual AKT plus endocrine therapy once CAPI gets approved, I think later this year.
So, wow, a lot to talk about there. I don't think we're going to be able to do it comprehensively. Hal, before we try to dive into the ER-positive metastatic scene, all these new things. There's a new phase 3 trial with CAPItello there that was positive that Virginia was commenting on. So before we start dissecting it out, a couple of questions in the chat room about adjuvant PARP, Hal. Francis wants to know, what other HRD abnormalities would you expect to see benefit from, in addition to BRCA, from adjuvant olaparib, for example, PALB2?
So it's an interesting question. In the metastatic setting, PALB2 definitely confers sensitivity to PARP inhibitors. And in fact, there's an 80% response rate to olaparib in women whose tumors are, who have a PALB2 mutation. So BRCA1, BRCA2, and PALB2 for sure. That's probably about it. The other hereditary mutations, even those involved in DNA repair and HRD in general, to date have not really predicted sensitivity to single-agent PARP inhibitor therapy in breast cancer. But, you know, keep watching this space because 2 days ago at ASCO GU, right, they had the TALAPRO study where they just threw a PARP inhibitor into men with castrate-resistant prostate cancer and an improved outcome. So, and that was unselected by HRD mutation. So, you know, we're all trying to learn from our own colleagues, but at the moment, it's just those three mutations.
Yeah, no, actually, they had seen a year before in prostate benefit with HRD, without HRD abnormalities in the same kind of setting. And we, of course, this afternoon, when we talk about ovarian cancer, Dr. Matulonis and Vera will get into that scene as well. Just one more question, and then maybe we'll let Hal bring in some of the new triple negative data. Virginia, I don't even know where to begin with metastatic ER positive, but what about this new drug, CAPI? Can you talk a little bit about tolerability issues with it, how it compares to alpelisib, how the target, you know, it's AKT, how that compares to alpelisib, Anything you want to say about this new agent? That, I mean, it's a phase 3 positive trial. It seems like, as you said, it's probably going to be an option very soon. What do we do about it?
So there was a little bit of a surprise with the Capitello data, because we all thought that that Capi would be an effective drug in the AKT pathway mutated tumors, and the data clearly suggested that Capi is active regardless of AKT pathway alterations, which is a great option for our patients, but it comes with some toxicities. We're going to talk about some diarrhea, we're going to talk about some nausea and rash as well, and so it's definitely not a benign combination, and that's something that we need to think about, especially when we try to decide whether to give that or give elacestrant, which was very well tolerated in clinical trials. But I think, honestly, based on the CAPI data, we're probably going to be using much less alpelisib in the future.
I have a question to Virginia, and before we move to Hal. Patients who have visceral disease, you know, ER positive, I mean, we've been doing this for a long time, you know, they have to need chemotherapy. You know, basically everybody should have started, you know, hormone therapy and CDK, in your opinion. And the other question is, people, you know, prospective, you know, maybe, do you look for ESR mutation in patients who's getting AI oral plus CDK4 and switch them? There was a presentation about that. I know maybe you have 1 minute to talk about that. Thanks.
So there was a nice presentation at San Antonio, the Right Choice trial, that looked at patients not only that had visceral metastases, but they had rapidly progressing visceral metastases, almost a visceral crisis. And it compared ribociclib endocrine therapy to combination chemotherapy and RIBO1. So based on that trial, I don't think that there's a single patient with ER-positive metastatic breast cancer that I would not offer a CDK4/6 inhibitor to, assuming that they are, you know, ER-positive, not 5 or 7% ER-positive, but strongly ER-positive. As far as the ESR1 mutations, there was a presentation last year by a French group looking at the progression of disease and the molecular progression, which really means in many cases that you're seeing accumulation of ESR1 mutations, and switching at that point from an AI to fulvestrant improves outcomes. Now, this was a smaller trial. We still need confirmatory trials. But just a reminder for the group that when we assess ESR1 mutations, we don't want to assess them at one time point. These are mutations that develop over time once a cancer becomes endocrine resistant. And so these are serial testing with ctDNA that will potentially capture an ESR1 mutation.
Thank you. Hal?
So the last few slides take us back to triple negative breast cancer, and we've alluded to some of these issues already. So I'll be brief and we can do more Q&A. But the first question was, which patients with triple negative disease in the early stage should get neoadjuvant pembrolizumab with chemotherapy, and should you continue that in the adjuvant setting? The second question is easy. We have zero data. So we do it because that's what the regimen was, but we don't actually know how important it is. The data for this come from the KEYNOTE 522 study. I think many of you have seen this before. It was a study of intensive chemotherapy with taxane, carboplatin, followed by AC, all given with or without pembrolizumab for stage 2 or 3 triple negative breast cancer. And in the first reports, we saw that adding pembro did improve the rate of pathologic complete response. We also saw that the PD-L1 testing did not uniquely predict which patients were likely to benefit from pembrolizumab or not. And in follow-up, we've now seen that there's actually an improvement in recurrence-free survival, as shown on the right, favoring the pembrolizumab-based regimen. So based on that, this has really become our go-to regimen for higher-risk presentations of triple-negative breast cancer. Now, how many of you actually round, like, on an inpatient service ever? Anybody here rounds on an inpatient service? Okay. I just finished a week on service, and I can tell you, this is a lot more toxic a regimen than we've ever had in breast cancer since the era of high-dose chemotherapy. So this is a very challenging regimen. The chemotherapy itself is more intense, and the pembrolizumab obviously gives unusual immune-related side effects. And we've seen substantial hepatopathies, we've seen colitis, we've seen not just skin rashes, but real desquamating type skin problems and other things. This is not for the faint-hearted or for the unfit patient. So stage 3 cancer, yes, very high-risk tumor for sure. Stage 2, node positive. Stage 2, maybe really big tumors, 4 centimeters or more. There had been a brewing academic debate, like if you saw somebody with a clinical 1 to 2 centimeter triple negative breast cancer, shouldn't we be thinking about neoadjuvant therapy with pembrolizumab because it was so effective? I would not do that. This is a much more toxic regimen, and we are seeing a much greater frequency of truly life-threatening toxicities than I've encountered ever with like ACT and all those things since the GCSF era. So again, and then finally, no data on whether there's a role for the adjuvant treatment here. And then we alluded to this a little bit about the sequencing for triple negative. And again, these are data from the related KEYNOTE-355 study. And in this study, the outcomes were a little different in the sense that PD-L1 expression was an important marker here. And the more PD-L1 positive the tumor is, the more important pembrolizumab looks to be. So our cut point is a CPS score of around 10. But if you actually look at the data, it's really a higher group, more like a CPS score of 20 or greater, that gets the lion's share of the extra benefit of pembro. So we test all the tumors. If it's PD-L1 positive, it's pembro with chemo, either taxane or gemcitabine carboplatin, where the regimen's used in the study. And if it's not, then it's typically first-line chemotherapy. And then second-line becomes olaparib, as we've talked about, in the adjuvant setting if there's a BRCA mutation. Again, mostly just underscoring the point Virginia made that everybody who has metastatic disease now needs genetic testing. And then we have the choice of the antibody drug conjugate, sacituzumab versus physician's choice here in the ASCENT trial, showing an improvement in response, but also improvement in overall survival. And finally, of course, the subset of patients in the DESTINY study, which were triple negative, and again showing an important benefit in progression-free survival. So my takeaway here would be terrific to have new options for metastatic triple negative breast cancer. This is a disease that needed targeted therapies, and we finally come along with some. Again, we made this point earlier, most patients will have already seen some chemotherapy, and that affects your options. Obligatory to test the tumor for PD-L1, obligatory to get genetic testing, and then a common algorithm, which we've already articulated, would be chemo with or without pembro based on PD-L1 status, then your ADC approaches, and then your second ADC approach perhaps, or just regular chemotherapy, and we see how patients do. And hopefully this means some real progress for these folks.
Thank you.
So, you know, your thoughts about the toxicity of 522 is very interesting. I haven't heard anybody verbalize it. I'll be curious whether NASFAD and Virginia have the same impression. There's a question in the chat room, Hal, sort of as a follow-up from Dr. Kumar from the FCS, who said, you said no pembro for a triple negative 1 to 2 centimeter. Do you give him neoadjuvant therapy or adjuvant?
Well, it really depends on whether they're a surgical candidate. You know, the point of the therapy in the neoadjuvant setting is to really deliver systemic therapy and improve surgical outcomes. The one unique piece of triple negative is we can also sometimes tailor the out-back approach based on the CREATE-X trial, which offers the opportunity to add capecitabine if they have residual disease. Though parenthetically, most of us remain a little skeptical that it really does all that much. So usually if the surgeon can go to the operating room and resect what would be a clinical stage 1 tumor, that would be our first approach for a new diagnosis of triple negative disease. And you know, the question that sometimes arises is a patient who had surgery first but then is found to have more extensive nodal disease for whatever reason. And there we talk about whether we should add the pembrolizumab based on the KEYNOTE-522 data, with the acknowledgement that there really aren't a lot of data that, you know, that it helps in that setting of adjuvant, pure adjuvant setting. And I think the way out of this box ultimately is going to be the circulating tumor DNA. I mean, that's going to be the test which is going to help us understand whether there really is a residual burden of tumor that warrants treatment. And I don't think we're there yet with the test, but half the San Antonio posters next year are going to be about circulating tumor DNA. You're going to have to read all those and screen them and filter them. But there's a debate about how sensitive the assay needs to be and how robust and how much validation and all these kind of things. But that's going to be the strategy to escape this box of throwing all these drugs at all these at everybody.
Yeah, just stick around for the next module and see what the GI people have to say about circulating DNA. Virginia, any thoughts? And then I'll go to you, Nasfat. in terms of, again, the 522 scenario. Charles in the chat room has a patient with a 3 to 4 centimeter triple negative tumor, who had a lot of problems with neoadjuvant chemo, just got through carboplatin, pembro, but went to surgery, had a path CR, wants to know, do you need to give post-op chemo? What about post-op pembro? Any general thoughts about the whole 522 scene, Virginia?
It definitely is tough to give. And up until some data from this year or last year's SABCS, I was still questioning why we needed to do the carboplatin. I think now we've all kind of decided that carbo is probably a standard of care regimen, but it is not easy to give. For the patient scenario that you just mentioned, I personally would not give any more chemotherapy. The patient had a PCR, but I would continue the pembrolizumab, assuming that the toxicity profile from that was manageable during the neoadjuvant course.
So, Nasfet, any comments, any experiences you want to relate?
We're very comfortable in giving immunotherapy and chemotherapy in a lot of cancers, and probably the regimen adding carboplatin to neoadjuvant pretty tough. Even before the era of immunotherapy, we struggled with the cytopenia in these patients, so that could be the issue. I have a question to the faculty about, I mean, patients who have like neoadjuvant immunotherapy and they have residual disease, do you combine post-surgery capecitabine with pembrolizumab, or if they have like, you know, BRCA mutation positive? I mean, I know this probably the trial is addressing this issue, but if you want to get your opinion.
Yeah, so it's a great question about what do you do about residual disease, and there are a couple of different contexts where this comes up. One is what you just said, triple negative disease, you know, would you add the capecitabine with the pembro? We often do this, you know, thinking that, well, if it worked in CREATE-X and it worked in 522, let's, you know, put them together. And that's something that for higher risk patients, I think, makes sense. The other context where this comes up has been in the setting of ER-positive disease, where if there's a BRCA mutation and there's also high risk, you know, do you give abemaciclib? Do you give olaparib? Do you give one, then the other? My own gestalt has been that I tend to use the olaparib if they have a BRCA mutation, because I think that the survival data are pretty important there. And you can actually add the abemaciclib later if you still feel compelled to do that. But I don't know what your practice has been.
I do the same thing. And I was struck last year from the data Nick Turner presented on these triple negative breast cancer patients with residual disease. And 80% of them after surgery had visible metastatic disease. This is a very high-risk patient population that we have to do everything we can. There's trials out there looking at ctDNA and trying to tailor treatment, such as the PERSEVERE trial, which I think are what we need to do. But I feel that these patients need treatment, even if it is capecitabine, although I'm very skeptical of that data as well.
And when do you use like olaparib or talazoparib, you know, in patients with metastatic disease? You know, how you sequence it, like after the first-line chemo?
So
or after you exhaust your chemotherapy, where you put
the So the that's drug? Interesting. An update just last week from the Olympiad trial, so our metastatic olaparib trial, showed that there was an overall survival benefit if you gave olaparib in the first-line setting. And that benefit was 22 months versus 14 months. Hazard ratio 0.55. So that's pretty impressive. Now, obviously, if somebody's PD-L1 positive, you're going to give the anti-PD-L1 therapy first. But I tend to give olaparib as early as I can.
Thank you.
Can I just bring back one question we got earlier that we never got to address, and it's such an important clinical question. I'll ask Cal. We were talking earlier about T-DXd, and the question is screening for ILD in a patient on T-DXd with no respiratory symptoms. You know, assuming the patient doesn't have a reason to want to image the chest, Hal, I'm starting to hear people say they're still trying to get imaging as often as possible, maybe every 3 cycles. Are you doing preemptive imaging when patients on TDXD, and for how long, Hal?
Yeah, does anybody here married to a malpractice attorney or anything like that? Am I at liberty to speak or work for the FDA? No, I've stopped doing that. I mean, we get scans usually frequently enough in metastatic breast cancer, typically every 12 weeks or 16 weeks. And so if a patient is asymptomatic and they're on more or less that schedule, that's all I do. I'm not getting every 8-week or other short interval scans just looking for ILD.
And it's interesting, that question came up at SABCS, and Sarah Hurvitz said, well, the package insert said, do you do scans every 6 weeks? And I was petrified because I don't do that either. I do my three-month scans unless a patient has any sort of symptom.
I'll tell you some other things we don't do. We don't get echoes every 3 months in patients on trastuzumab. Do you get echoes every three?
I typically do.
We're still doing that. So how?
I also do not check estrogen levels in women getting ovarian suppression. I don't bother with that.
It's I don't
either. Always low. And I never want to disagree in public with Virginia, but I think that premenopausal women with oncotype scores that are less than 25, some of them can still get ovarian suppression, mm-hmm. not chemotherapy. So there's always more to come.
Always. I think we're about ready to move on for our GI cancers here.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.